Were you an only child?
I was an only child. My parents were fairly comfortable. My father was a cattle dealer because it was in that area where most of the Jews were cattle dealers. Every second Thursday was a big cattle market in Lingen, which still exists until today.
Tell me a little bit about your mother.
We had a fairly Orthodox household, Jewish Orthodox, but at the same time were very modern. My mother was extremely Orthodox and even kept up the dietary laws in the concentration camp, which didn't help her much. My mother was just a housewife. She loved singing, loved going to the theater, which was not in Lingen, but in the nearest town, which was Osnabrück and Münster. We were very close families. My uncles and aunts and cousins all lived very near, not in Lingen, but in the province Lingen. We saw each other very often. My father was very outgoing. He was a soldier in the First World War, and he was, even though he was Jewish, quite proud of it. He served with the Hussars, and he won the decoration, the first, the Iron Cross, first class and second class for Verdun.
Tell me a little bit about your school.
First of all, I went to kindergarten when I was little, even though we had two maids, the big Maria and the little Maria. The little Maria was actually in charge of me. I've got a picture of her still, and I'm in touch with her. She's well over 90. I went first to the kindergarten, and then I went to an ordinary school in Lingen. It was a Protestant school. Even so, Lingen was predominantly Catholic. I was there until 7, and then I started school at 7, and at 11 I went to the high school, to the gymnasium in Lingen. I had lots of friends, lots of neighbors. I was very, very popular. I was in the school choir and in the local sports club. And I was one of them, which suddenly changed when, of course, in 1933 Hitler came to power. And we had teachers at this school who were very pro-Nazi, went to the Nuremberg rally each year. And I was the only Jewish girl in this high school. And this particular teacher made my life a misery. She told the girls not to talk to me. During the intervals, I stood on my own in the playground. Some of the teachers came to talk to me out of pity, but were afraid of this one teacher because I might denounce them. And girls with whom I used to go to school in the mornings, and I met afterwards, and we played on the way, and they suddenly ignored me because all of the fear of this one teacher. And she arranged then that I would sit right at the back of the class, and two rows were left vacant, and I sat against the wall. In 1937, there came a law, more or less at the same time as the Nuremberg laws came out, that all the Jewish children had to leave German schools and universities. So it was from one day to the next.
Can I take you just back a little bit, Ruth, before we go further on? I wondered if you could just tell me a little bit more about your hobbies and activities in the sports club.
Well, I won 3 prizes in running at the sports festival. And I went there every Friday afternoon. I did gymnastic and ball games, and that was it.
As an only child, who did you play with? Who were your neighbors?
I played with the neighbors' children, as you see on the pictures. and also with school friends. And of course my cousins always came to us, and we always had a very lively crowd. In the summer we used to go to the forest to pick berries, not out of necessity, but because we enjoyed it. We went on with horse and cart. My father arranged, and all the kids went to the forest and picked berries. And the life was very good. My father belonged to the local male choir and to a rifle shooting club. And we lived like one of the Germans, even though we were very Jewish at heart and at home.
Can you tell me about the little synagogue in Lindlingen and about the Jewish holidays?
We had a small synagogue in Lingen, which of course was burned out on the Kristallnacht. And there was a service every Friday night and Saturday mornings. And during the Jewish high festivals, which we are having at the moment, we had a rabbi coming to take the service. Otherwise, members of the Jewish community volunteered to take the service over. And it was very festive on days, on our New Year's Day and on our Yom Kippur, on our Day of Atonement. Men would go to the synagogue in top hats and women were dressed up, but it was not ostentatious. It was all done in very good taste and very, very nice. And the people in Lingen, and also that part of Germany, they appreciated their Jews. Being religious themselves, mainly, as I mentioned before, Catholics, they appreciated somebody else sticking to their beliefs.
Apart from the changes that took place in school, what changes took place in the town and with your neighbors?
There was a boycott. I don't know now which time. I think it was fairly early after Hitler came to power. When in the town there were a few Jewish stores. They put SA men outside, big slogans: Germans don't buy from Jews. The Jews are our Jews.
Can you remember it in German? Say it in German.
Deutsche kauft nicht bei Juden. Die Juden sind unser Unglück. They smashed the windows and they looted the shops. My father, as I said before, was a cattle dealer. The farmers didn't dare, even though they were quite sympathetic, didn't dare to deal with Jewish people anymore, and so it became very hard. My mother had quite a bit of jewelry which she had to sell in order to raise some money, and times were tough.
Tell us about being sent away to your aunt and then going to school in Berlin.
As I had to leave school, my mother said, "You're not staying at home doing nothing. You're going to your aunt." My aunt lived in a very small village, also in that part of Germany. She had 7 sons, and they had an enormous farm. So I had to work there very hard. I was one of them. Had to get up early in the morning, scrub the floors, and go out milking the cows with some of my cousins. And I was on a waiting list to go to the Jewish school in Berlin. And I stayed with his aunt nearly for a year. Then I went to Berlin to a Jewish school. It was the Adas Yisroel in Siegmundshof. There I took my O-levels, the equivalent of O-levels. And afterwards I got, my mother and father saw to it, I got a place to train as a kindergarten teacher and a nurse, because at that time we still thought there might be a chance of me emigrating to Palestine, and it would be very useful.
Did you How did you hear about what happened on Crystal Night and the arrest of your father?
My father had an incident before that when he walked through Lingen, and one of the hooligans said to him, "Willem, and I want you to go to Palestine. You have no right to live here." And he hit my father so much that my father fell to the ground, and he kicked him, so he made him lame. For the rest of he severed a nerve, and for the rest of my father's life, he could not walk. He walked with a limp. And he was taken into Schutzhaft. They said my father was imprisoned. Schutzhaft, they said, so that nobody else can do anything to him. So there he was for a few weeks, but was released. And I was in Berlin, and I got a telephone call from my mother, which she went to neighbors, because Jews at that time already were not allowed to have telephones or radio sets. She went to a neighbor at night and phoned somebody in Berlin, who gave me a message that my father was arrested and the synagogues had been burned. But that was not just in Lingen, it was all over Germany. Men were arrested, sent to Sachsenhausen, Buchenwald and Dachau, and everywhere they burned the synagogues down. So I came, I had got special permission, and I went to Lingen to be with my mother. And we had a curfew. We were not allowed to go out, but not as bad as later when we lived in the Judenhouses.
What was the feeling of the local police, who all knew you very well?
Yes, when they arrested my father, I was told by my father after his release, when they arrested my father to take him to Buchenwald with the other Jewish males from the town, this policeman said, "Willem, you walk in front of us. You are not a criminal. You didn't do anything." They were all very sympathetic, but everybody was, of course, very scared and frightened. They didn't want to be shown to be too sympathetic to the Jews.
Tell us what you did, Ruth, to try to get the release of your father.
When I was in Lingen at that time, I said to my mother, as my father had these high decorations from the First World War, he must have a military pass, which he still had, we found. And with his pass and with the documents that he had, those iron crosses, I went to the Gestapo to Osnabrück. And they promised me, as my father was in the First World War, that they would release him very soon. And he did come home after about 4 weeks. But then Göring let out a law that all the Jews who were fighting in the First World War should be released from the concentration camps, those who were arrested during the Kristallnacht. But my father was one of the first ones that came home. And he came home in a very bad condition.
After that, presumably, there were thoughts of escape. So
My father always said, "Look, I'm so well known here, they won't do anything more to me, what they have done already. And things can't get worse. They can only, if they stay like this, they will improve eventually." But then things get so bad, and we couldn't emigrate anywhere, so in desperation he went to Hamburg to a Siamese consul, and from there he got a visa for Siam. Each time I see or hear the king and I think of my poor father. We might have ended up in Siam.
I'm going to miss out on the
Could you just stop it there? If you want to go back to sort of cute question, or whatever. There's two.
And speak.
So, at school, Did the curriculum change at all after?
Yes, it did change. I mean, instead of history, we had German history. We had this particular teacher who was a headmistress of the school. She brought special pictures. Oh, God.
Okay, whenever you like.
So Ruth, perhaps you could tell us how the school curriculum changed.
The curriculum didn't change at all, except for history classes. And this particular teacher, who was the headmistress of the school, brought in big cardboard pictures of Jews. They called them Stürmer Jews, with big noses, flat feet, big bellies, bushy eyebrows. And they said, these are the Jews, these are the vermin of society, they have to be destroyed. And one girl got up and said, but Ruth Heilbronn, that was my maiden name, doesn't look like that. Neither do her parents nor the other Jewish people in this town. So she punished her, she got lines to write and was sent out of the class. But otherwise, they were all afraid and they sort of left me alone. I wasn't personally molested.
Tell us about the signs that started to go up in the town.
Not in the town, but on the shops of the Jewish shopkeepers. It said, "Die Juden sind unser Unglück." The Jews are our misfortune. Juda verrecke. Jews perish.
Given your father's serving in the First World War and his decorations, how much of a German identity did you feel in your family?
Not much. It came out more during Hitler time, because my father thought, being a veteran of the First World War, it might make things easier. But we were very Jewish at heart, very Zionistic, and very religious. But this was, we were not uppermost Germans, even though the family of my father was in Germany already since the 17th century, since 1600 and something. They came from Holland or Spain, I'm not quite sure.
After the war broke out and you were back at school in Berlin, I'd like to pick up from there and get you to tell us about hearing from your parents to say that they were going to be deported to Riga.
After I'd taken the equivalent of O-levels in Berlin, I started at a kindergarten seminar in Berlin, and at the same time at the Iranian Burgerstraße, which was a Jewish hospital, for training. But I trained only for a little while, because then the war broke out, and things became very difficult. I was only allowed to go home with special permission. Jews had special compartments on the trains with special permit. And as I said before, we had no more telephone, and everything went by letter.
So when did you hear from your parents that they were going to be deported?
That was in December 1941. I got a telegram from my mother, which was sent by very good neighbors, because she was not allowed to go to the post office to send it, that they were deported to the east on the 10th or 12th of December. I'm not quite sure of the exact date. So I volunteered, being an only child, I volunteered to go with them. And but in the meantime, the Jews had to leave their homes and were put into Judenhouses, in houses where only Jews lived. There was a curfew from 6 o'clock in the evening until 7 o'clock at night. We had Russian cards, special Russian cards, as the war broke out, with a G on it, meaning Jude, meaning Jew. And only at certain times, at certain shops, we were allowed to get our provisions.
And Why did your parents think that they were being taken east?
Because it was the notification. They would be deported to east for war essential work. And we were allowed to take 100 pounds of 100 pounds of luggage with us. And we waited carefully not to have a gram more or a pound more than the 100 grams, and allowed one rucksack and blankets to take. We were on the, it was on a Saturday morning, and as I said before, my mother was very orthodox. She was most upset. We were taken to the railway station, and that was the first time that she traveled on a Sabbath. One policeman from the town accompanied us, and he cried all the way, because that is quite important. It was a policeman by the name of Brandt, and he had to deliver us to Osnabrück, where we were in a big sports center, lying on straw for a few days, and then back on the train to Bielefeld. And this transport was called the Bielefelder transport, which consisted of 100 Jews from the area of Münster, Osnabrück, Rheine, and Bielefeld. But shortly after we left Lingen, we saw already that the goods train, which had our luggage on, was taken off. So we lost already our few bits, which we were supposed to be able to take with us. So we only had our hand luggage. So in Osnabrück, we were taken onto these old railway trains, about 15 to 18 people to one compartment.
Can you describe the conditions on the train and what the journey was like?
The journey was horrendous. It took either 3 days and four nights or 4 days and three nights, I can't remember. We had hardly any sanitations. We had a bucket which overflowed. There was no water. They didn't give us any water. We couldn't wash ourselves. People became ill. People committed suicide. Babies died. It was a terrific journey. The further we came east, the colder it got. The windows froze over. We couldn't look out where we were. In any case, we were not allowed to open the windows. The doors were bolted. They put seals on it so that nobody got in or out of it. And the windows froze over, so we didn't even know where we were. And then suddenly the train stopped. It stopped a few times on the journey, but suddenly the train stopped. The doors were pulled open, and everybody, and outside they shouted, "Raus, raus," that means out, out. We were stiff, we could hardly walk, because it was by that time minus 20 degrees frost. And lots of people got frostbites, couldn't walk, and the SS came in with their big dogs and truncheons and were herding us out of the railway trains. And there we stood on the side of Chirotava. That was a goods train outside Riga. We had our hand luggage, we had to leave as well, had to put in one heap. And the wind was howling, and the ice was on the road and snow. And we had to get in rows of five, we had to march, or six, I'm not quite sure, towards the Riga ghetto, but we didn't know where we were going. SS men with rifles and truncheons and big dogs were accompanying us. And with loud hailers they were saying, "Who is not able to walk? Old people and mothers with children, you will have to have it comfortable. You don't have to walk to the ghetto, or you don't have to walk any further. There are some vans waiting for you. You go onto these lorries and you'll meet your loved ones as soon again." But later on, after the war, I found out that these lorries their portable gas chambers. They had gas in it, and the people got gassed on these vans and taken to the forest and were buried there, some of them even alive. But these were told to us afterwards. We didn't know at the time. We only knew that these vans, grey vans, they never arrived. So we walked to the ghetto, and a very nasty incident happened on the way, which we couldn't explain at the time. In front of us walked a young couple. They didn't live very far from Lingen. The mother had a little child on her hand, and the father had the child on his hand, and the mother had a child in her arm. And one of the SS men came and said to the little child, "Would you like a sweetie?" And the child very shyly said, "Yes." The child didn't know how to answer. So the SS man said, "Open your mouth." The child did it, and he shot through the mouth of the child on the hand of the father. So my father said, "By God, what's going to happen here? We were sent to work here. What is going to expect us?" But we were not really allowed to talk to one another. And the nearer we came to what then was the ghetto, we didn't know where they were taking us. We saw in the snow, we saw pink, dirty brown, big stains, as big as a human being, stains. And later on we found out that they shot the people, and it was the blood. They shot the people who couldn't walk anymore, and the blood sipped through the snow. We came to the Riga ghetto. This was a part of the Riga Vorstadt, an old part of the Riga town, which was called Riga Vorstadt. There we saw the barbed wire, watchtowers, and already SS, but this time I think they were Latvian SS or Lithuanian SS, controlling the streets around the ghetto. We were herded into this ghetto. There were old wooden houses infested with bugs. And as we got there, we saw what has happened here before, because we saw that people must have left it before us in a hurry. Wardrobes were pulled open, clothes were thrown about, and food was on the table, which was frozen, solid frozen, with a spoon inside of the saucepan or plate. So that showed us that people here must have left in a hurry. We found out later on that 3 days before we arrived, they killed 30,000 Latvian Jews, which came from Riga and the surrounding towns into the ghetto. They killed them, they herded them into the Bikany forest, that is the Hochwald, that's outside Riga, where previously the Russian prisoners of war had dug graves for them. So they had to undress completely, sorted out their clothes, their top clothes, their underwear, their shoes, all in neat order. They had to leave, and then they had to go to the edge of the pits, and they were mown down with machine guns. And later on, this is all after the war, we were told that farmers nearby said that the soil was moving for days afterwards, because people that fell into these pits were not dead, not all of them. So they were still alive, and they suffered a terrible end. So we came to this Riga ghetto, and we lived in these poor houses where those poor people were driven out of and murdered. It was chaos. We had nothing to eat. We had no material to heat the fires, to warm ourselves. But we got some clothes from those poor people, which they had taken from town and left behind. So at least we had some clothes to put on.
How did your parents try to create some semblance of normality there? How did they trust?
There was no normality. You just had to adjust to the circumstances. There was no normality. We got, after a little while, we had to register. We registered with the Bielefelder Gruppe because that was the transport we came with. We had our, they formed a Jewish police. We had a little hospital there where I went to and worked, but we had no medicines and no instruments, and we couldn't do much for them. We had excellent doctors in the ghetto itself, not just from the Bielefelder transport, but they were helpless, they couldn't do much. But later on, we had a beautiful hospital, and the Red Cross, we don't know how it came about, supplied instruments for the surgeons there, because nobody, women who came to the Riga ghetto and were found out they were pregnant still from home, had to interrupt their pregnancy and had to have abortions, or even laparotomies. I mean, it had to be taken by operation.